Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you are here with Healing with Dr. Daniels at BlakeRadio.com. And we have a really exciting title tonight. It's the medical model. And this is something that, it's probably not widely known, but medical schools actually hire actresses and models to impersonate patients so medical students can learn. And the scripted behavior these models exhibit when physical exams are done or being questioned by the doctor, in my opinion, shields the future doctor from what a real patient might say. So hiring medical models, instead of allowing medical students to experience real patients, shields the future doctor from the anger, wrath, disappointment, hostility, frustration, and pain that a real patient might actually express, and thus fill the poor young doctor with doubt. And so it gives these young doctors a pretty rosy picture of the true consequences of standard of care. So tonight we have a special guest with us, a real live medical model. Annette, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing, Dr. Daniel?
Fine. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to the audience tonight. And can
you tell for
inviting me? Yeah, I'm just absolutely thrilled. Of course, Annette and I, we've known each other for, 20 years now?
At least. At least that long, yes. And all
okay.
of those years have been very informing.
So tell us your background, because you're not just any medical model. Tell us, I mean, really, tell the audience how great you are.
You know, my title is a standardized patient, but that's the same as a medical model. I guess some of the hospitals use that term, but the term that's used locally is the standardized patient. But my background, I have a bachelor's degree in theater production, and it's really interesting because when I actually was in school, I wanted to just train and study to be an actress, but I was young then, and I wanted to be an aspiring actress, but my professors were explaining to me that while I'm auditioning for various roles in various areas, and how am I going to pay the bills? So you want to be able to have a varied background. So the theater production degree, you know, also trained me in stage management and set design, costume design, and I didn't realize how valuable that would be until I got into the real world. And when I would go to audition, I would also share all of those other areas of training that I had in the industry, the theater industry. And I usually landed some job, whether it was acting or costuming or set design or production assistant. So I was very excited with the education that I got because it was...
Wow. So when you went to an audition, it wasn't just get the audition or not. I mean, you had choices.
I had major choices, and one
wow.
of the reasons why I think I've been working in the industry so long is because of my varied training and my varied background. Because as I say, I run the gamut. I direct, I teach, I also, and that became the latter years, actually. We weren't really trained in directing. But after mm-hmm. you've been to enough rehearsals, you kind of get the flow. But then you can also go and do some directing training. But, yes, I absolutely would land, we call it a gig.
Yeah, pretty high rate of success.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, you've been in some productions, too. What productions?
Oh, my God. Well, most recently, which was a fabulous experience, I got an opportunity to work with a woman by the name of Karen Franklin King, who we both have been artists in the Central New York area for over and probably more years than I want to say. But we crossed paths a lot, but we never got an opportunity to perform on the same stage, and we did get an opportunity to do Having Our Say, the first 100 years of the Delaney sisters, and it was a really well-received production by the Central New York area. Actually, we had to bring it back twice, and it sold out, but it was really a powering show. But I've done a lot of the shows that you're very familiar with, like Lorraine's Hansberry. I've played various roles there. The Wiz. I've also actually costumed The Wiz. And I can go on and on and on and on, and I don't know how that would relate to what I do, but what in terms of a standardized patient. But it has given me a lot of training. And of late, I find myself in an arena where I'm now training kids. So you can kind of tell how old I am, because the kids that I train now, they're bringing their kids to me to train.
Oh, okay. All right. So what kind of training do you have for being actually a medical model? Did they give you some training after they hired you, or what happened?
Well, actually, they kind of explain, you know, what your role is as a standardized patient. And, you know, each individual, they're carefully trained to portray patients to simulate common medical conditions. Mm-hmm. Or in other words, just a person trained to, in some cases, present their own condition in a standardized way. So you might have, you know, 10 women all trained for the same circumstance, the same character, but we all are presenting specific conditions and responses and triggers and different things of that nature, so that the students are able to respond appropriately or inappropriately, which we also discuss with them later.
Mm-hmm. But they tell you if the doctor asked you this, this is basically your answer. Is that the way that you're coached, or how does that work?
That's exactly it. There is, you know, we have parameters. We mm-hmm. are given our medical history. They tell us what our medical history is. They tell us whether our parents are living, and if they're not, you know, perhaps what they might have passed away from, because that usually plays a role in perhaps the condition that we're dealing with. Whether we smoke, whether we drink, you know, whether we're sexually active or have menopause, and, you know, if we do the kinds of, if we eat right. So there's a lot of those kinds of questions that we have to memorize and we have to answer. Mm-hmm. And the real challenge, you know, with that from an acting perspective is mm-hmm. not only do we have to retain that information, but we also have to kind of log in the response that's happening so that later we can give the feedback on what was done and how it was done and how it made us feel, you know, mm-hmm. when they did specific or said specific things.
Now, at the time they do or say those specific things, what you do is you don't let on at that time, but you discuss it later. Is that what you're instructed to do?
In some cases, yes, and it depends on the specific exam. Some exams are it's set up so that you can give feedback immediately. For example, like you're as a patient educator in the pelvic exam sessions, which I also mm-hmm. portray, those are exams that are so, you know, intimate. I mean, you do get exams in some of the standardized patients, but they're basic. You might get a chest exam. They might look in your ears, eyes, or do a neurological exam. But for pelvic exam, they actually do a pelvic exam, and they actually place a speculum inside your vagina. So in cases like that, we are actually giving, you know, spur-of-the-moment constructive or objective feedback. And there's also,
when you say objective, what do you mean by objective? You mean like giving them information they might not otherwise have?
Well, we talk about the language. For example, in terms of inserting the speculum, they may say, okay, I'm going to stick the speculum in now. And we would say, you know, well, I feel more comfortable if you'd say something like, you know, place the speculum. It sounds less intrusive or invasive. Also, what they may do in terms of touch you, like the inside of your thigh with the back of their hand before they actually touch your your vagina or examine the genitals. So it's to kind of keep the patient comfortable and prepare mm-hmm. to know what's going to happen, and also the language to use so that it keeps the patient as comfortable as possible. You're dealing with a patient that might have been attacked or raped. You don't want to say, okay, could you open your legs, or you don't want to actually force their legs open. You might want to say, okay, I'm going to place my hands on the outside of your knees, and could you relax your legs? So we go through that whole process. And then also, because we can tell them whether they're applying too much pressure, whether it's superficial pressure or whether it's very deep pressure, we can tell them how actually deep they can go, because a lot of times the medical students are very nervous and so they don't really apply enough pressure. And we indicate, you know, and even show them, see, you can press this hard. And it's all relative, because what level I may can tolerate in terms of my pain tolerance, someone else may not. But you have to be open and and relate to your patient, making sure that you're having eye contact when you have that sheet up over the legs. You want to be certain not to overexpose them. But at the same time, you want to have the sheet so that you can make eye contact, so that you're watching and making sure that the patient that you're actually examining, you know, if they're wincing or if they're squinting or something, you know, you might want to say, you know, are you okay, Annette? Is that just an uncomfortable squint, or is there some discomfort you're feeling in another way? And so it's those kind
of
things.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever, as a medical model, refused a procedure?
No.
Okay.
Because then, we know before we go into a procedure what procedure is going to happen.
Uh-huh.
But at any time, if there is we ever feel in danger or very uncomfortable or are being hurt or harmed in any way, we can certainly come out of character. And usually, because there is a clinician or a doctor present at the time, they usually mm-hmm. intercede before it gets that far.
Okay. And so have you ever had an uncomfortable procedure or uncomfortable experience as a medical patient?
You know, because I actually have a prolapsed uterus, mm-hmm. that sometimes sets up a challenge for the medical students and what they've been trained to do based on, you know, the books in black and white. You know, there's a certain way that you go and you do that. And, you know, they may talk about it, but it's certainly different when you're, you know, right there. And depending mm-hmm. on the phase of my prolapse, whether it's phase one or two, you know, and how low it is down, you know, in my vaginal cavity, they may have to adjust the speculum, because my cervix is right there. So mm-hmm. you may not want them. They may have to adjust. And sometimes I, you know, will tell them. And it may not be, that's not part of the case, because every woman is different, you know, that actually portrays a woman in a pelvic exam session. And you're going to have to deal with her personal anatomy, how it is. You know, we can't change that.
Now, before I go on to your actual experiences as a patient, is there anything else that you want to tell your listeners about medical students or being a medical model? Or is it a good thing? Is it not a good thing? How it impacts?
Well, personally, I think it is something that I feel every medical student should trained to do, because I've had the opportunity to actually be examined in the real world. For example, I do breast exam sessions as well. And mm-hmm. I've had, let's say it's just a cold exam with someone I don't know mm-hmm. who hasn't been through that training. And then I've actually had a breast exam by someone who has been through that training. And the difference is just so vast in terms of feeling respected and feeling comfortable, feeling like I can share information, as opposed to someone coming in, talking to me, and not making eye contact, or not really listening to me, or I feel like they're not really listening to me. And this training, I feel as if it provides that opportunity, because we also explain that before you actually do something, you should let the patient know what you're going to do prior to doing it. And you kind of feel more empowered when you have that opportunity as a real patient. And when I experienced that, it was kind of funny, because as a standardized patient, I'm having this real breast exam. And the actual clinician is going through the whole process, and I'm just like, wow, this really does work, because while I do the training, I've never had the opportunity to be on that side of the picture. And to be on that side, it really makes you feel honored that you are contributing to an industry to help the medical students recognize that this is not just a case, or it's not just a specimen. It is a living, breathing person who can respond and will tell you things if they feel comfortable. If they feel uncomfortable, or if they feel intimidated, or if they feel insulted, they may not say anything. They might just shake their head. You know, if you're using all of this medical jargon, and people normally, if you're talking about what's going on and you're using all this medical jargon, they 9 times out of 10 will just go, uh-huh. And then later, you know, may tell someone, I don't know what the heck they were talking about.
You mentioned to me before about an experience you had with a breast exam during one of the, tell us about that.
Well, actually, are you talking about the experience actually having someone that went through the program, or the actual
student? No, being a medical model, and the student actually found a lump.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, with several students. I was going through these sessions, and it was a morning session where I might have 4 breast exams, and 3 of the medical students in their findings after the exam had indicated that the African-American patient has a nodule. I don't know. I didn't read the actual finding material, but when the doctors who go and review the findings that they write and review their video and how they actually did the exam, when they read that information, they contacted the director of the clinical skills program, you know, my director, and indicated that 3 of the students notated that they found a node or a lump in my breast. And which I was aware of, it just didn't hurt. So I didn't figure that it was a problem. But when I actually went to the doctors and had it checked out, my director called me in, which I thought was very considerate of him not to just leave that message on the phone or anything. But he called me in to say he needed to talk to me and shared it in a very, very kind and considerate way. I'm someone that doesn't really panic when I hear things. I try to be as calm and cool and collected as possible, because panicking doesn't make a bad situation any better. Just adds to the chaos. So I went to the doctors, and they sent me through the sonogram, and I took a mammogram, and I found out it was a fluid-filled lump. And I wanted to actually keep it, because I really love the opportunity for the students to actually have found findings. And to be able to do what they're
trying. Did a biopsy then, and they removed it.
They did, because what ended up happening is I went in, and one of the clinicians, when one of the students found the lump a second time after me knowing this, they stepped back, and, you know, the look on their face was not the poker face that they're trained to. If they find something, they're either supposed to say, are you aware of this, and not, like, have their eyebrows recede behind their hairline and run out of the room or anything. And so the student just looked and referred to the actual doctor that was in the room, and she began to palpate the lump and asked me, was I aware of it? And I said, oh, yeah. She asked me, have you had this checked out? And I said, yes. And she says, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, I want to keep it so that the students have a finding. She says, oh, you silly girl. She said, you go and have that thing removed or aspirated. And that's what I did. And I found out it was just a one-day in-office procedure, which was very cool. I didn't have to get any anesthesia or chemicals, and I watched them put the needle in and remove the fluid. But what was interesting about that is the doctor who told me to have it removed, she says, you have that removed because it could be concealing something more serious. And it was concealing another lump, but it wasn't serious. So since then, I've had it removed, and I get my normal mammograms and breast exams, and it's been okie dokie.
Oh, okay. All right, we have a question here. I'm trying to see if a person ask their question. This is 7376, you're on the air. Hello? Okay, so I guess he didn't have a question. All right, so now we're going to talk about you, the real patient.
Okay.
Okay, a long time ago. So a long time ago, it must have been 1990-something. And you had a gallbladder situation. Tell the audience about that.
Well, you know, I had a the digestion of my food wasn't normal. It seems like everything that I ate either irritated me so bad where I had excruciating cramps, or either, you know, I would be running to the bathroom, upchucking, or either having diarrhea sometimes at the same time. And that went on for years, and a lot of it was out of some stress.
Mm-hmm.
My eating habits weren't the worst in the world. To hear my mother tell it, she says I eat like a bird because I eat a lot of nuts and berries and, you know, things like that. But stress is something can wreak havoc on your body. But I went and had it removed, and they did it. I think it's called laparoscopically. You know, they did a couple of cuts, and they went in and had it removed. And so after it was all over, you know, because of the inquisitive person that I am, I figured, okay, I don't have a gallbladder anymore. So what should I do? This is a question I was posing to the doctor. Okay, what do I need to do or not do, or what can I expect? And they just basically told me not to eat any spicy foods. Just don't, you know, you can eat whatever you want to eat, just don't eat any spicy foods. And what I learned, I did that. I just continued to eat, you know, and I love spicy foods. I didn't eat as much spicy foods, but I did recognize that my food wasn't getting solid. It was just going right through me. I would eat, and probably within a half an hour's time, I was running to the bathroom. And I would do this all day. All day. And then what ended up happening, I can remember, and I'm sure you can recall this, Dr. Daniels, you were having a, it was like a picnic, and you were introducing non-meat foods, I think, to...
Oh, yes.
And
vegetarian picnic, educate the public, yes.
Vegetarian, yeah. Yeah, and it was very informative, and the food was, you had some chili, and you had some, I think you even had hot dogs there, but you had vegetarian hamburgers, and it was just, I was amazed, because it all was really, really good. And then during the question and answer session, I posed that question to you, and you were the one that told me that, oh, you need to intake some enzymes, and it made a huge difference, I mean, literally overnight. I mean, even if I can't get, you know, if I'm not eating some dark green vegetables, getting a pickle or something with that, you know, some sauerkraut or something that's going to help me digest that food. And it made the biggest difference in the world. And it wasn't anything where I had to, because I was taking one of those things, peptide or Pepcid, these little pills. Because
a little purple pill, yes.
Yeah, because I was getting these, you know, just the cramps from the lack of, or the digestion.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. But thank you, Dr. Daniels.
So you didn't need the medicine at the time. Okay. Well, you're welcome. So basically what happened was you had this condition. They recommended you get the gallbladder out. You got it out. Now, did the condition just totally go away or not really? And that's why you needed the Pepcid.
The condition didn't totally go away, not until I started eating the enzymes. But it didn't totally go away. But now that I eat the enzymes, and I know when I don't, because then I have that, my digestion isn't the same. But now I know I have to eat certain kind of fiber. I've been getting so many fruits and vegetables, and so now I'm on top of it now.
Okay, so now the listeners probably, they've already heard these episodes, but you're going to have to go back and watch the breast cancer episode. I did an episode on breast cancer.
Oh, okay.
And breast lumps. All right, so... Now we got to talk about something happened in February. What happened in February?
Oh, my God. The shock of my life. In February, I got a call from a friend of mine who asked me, invited me to a Super Bowl party. I went to the Super Bowl. I had never been to a Super Bowl party because, you know, I don't watch football and all of that. They actually walked in and people were like, who are you for? I didn't even know who was playing. But there was... ample food, and it was not vegetarian, Dr. Daniels. There was all kinds of chicken wings and pizza and all that stuff, and I ended up bringing some fresh fruit and some deviled eggs. But when I got there, watched the Super Bowl, had a lot of fun, and then we started playing games, and the Wii game, in fact, where you dance.
Yeah, I know that one.
Yeah, they do the dance, and then you repeat the dance, and if, depending on how well you repeat what they do, you just accumulate all these points, you know, and the music is pumping, and I was dropping it like it was hot, Dr. Daniels. It was just having a great time, and then all of a sudden when it was all over, you know, we're all laughing and having a great time, my left eye started burning, and I thought like sweat went into my eye, and so I went into the bathroom, and I got a paper towel and put some cold water on it to try to wipe it out, but it wasn't going away, so I went to look in the mirror, and I couldn't see very well, so I thought to myself, what is going on? So then I pulled my glasses off, because when things are blurry, I think my glasses are dirty. I pulled my glasses off, and they weren't dirty, so I sat on the toilet to kind of pull myself together, because I said, wow, maybe I'm drinking too much. I don't, you know, but I don't drink too much, you know. I haven't, you know, ever really been drunk in my life other than when I was first introduced to alcohol. My mother can tell you about that, because she threw me in a cold shower. I came out of the bathroom, and that's when I started experiencing this very unusual feeling of imbalance. It wasn't dizzy. It wasn't, it was just, and I didn't know what to think of it, but I knew enough to know something is wrong. And so I literally, I went into the living room, and I saw a friend of mine. I grabbed him by his arm, and I locked into his arm, and I pulled him into the kitchen. And I said to him, I said, something's really wrong. I feel very, very strange. And he said to me, you think you had too much to drink? And I said, no, you know, I only had a couple of drinks, and I think something's wrong. Well, he was like, well, you know, he was teasing me because we're both over 50. And he's like, well, you know, Annette, we can't probably tolerate our liquor like we used to, and we're getting older. And you know what they say, when you get 50, everything goes awry. You know, they're, you know, he's making all these jokes. Well, the whole time I'm sitting there going, no, no, something's wrong. And by that time, another friend of mine comes into the kitchen, and he goes, you know, that friend, you know, Jack, he says to Warren, and he says, you know, Annette thinks something's wrong. And I said, yeah, something's seriously wrong. So I said to him, I think you're really going to have to call 911. And he said, seriously? Then by that time, I'm slurring. And so when I started slurring, they both started laughing, thinking, yeah, she's drunk. You had too much to drink, and that listened to you, you know. And I'm like literally going, no, no, I'm trying to say 911, but I'm sure it's not coming out like 911. And then my girlfriend, who I actually came to the Super Bowl party with, she walks in, you know, hey, what are you guys doing? And she immediately looked at me, and thank God she recognized the signs of a stroke. And she said, oh, my God, she's having a stroke, call 911. So they call 911, and I go into the so within from the time my first symptom started until the time I got into the emergency room, it was about probably 45 minutes, and max hour and a half. But they got me there pretty rapidly. But I'll tell you, I was totally lucid throughout the entire ordeal. I was very aware. I was tingling hands and fingers. The paramedics came in and was asking me, you know, how many fingers. They were asking me my names. I was trying to tell them tingle, tingle, tingle. But I couldn't because, of course, half my face was paralyzed. My whole left side was paralyzed. And they got me into the ambulance. It was horrific. Everybody is, you know, there's like this panic around you. Everybody around you is panicking. And, you know, I upchucked, and I finally got to the emergency room, and I was horrified because I, you know, you got all these strangers that are pulling and tugging, and nobody's telling you what they're going to do. They're just trying to rip your clothes off, and, you know, and it was just really a complete nightmare. I felt like I was being attacked, because there were probably 8 to 10 people in the room, and people were taking off my socks. I had somebody pulling up my turtleneck while someone was pulling down my underwear. Oh. And the that was pulling off my turtleneck didn't take my necklace that I had on, so they were choking me. So the hand that I did have, I was able to pull my turtleneck down and literally rip my own necklace off and show the nurse that. And then she said, you know, oh, I didn't realize that. But I just finally kind of screamed and did whatever it was I had to do to get everybody's attention. And they kind of stopped. And I said, you know, don't touch before tell. My girlfriend was interpreting. She was the only one that could understand me. And she was saying, she doesn't want you to touch her before you tell her what she's going to do. Please explain what you're doing. Overwhelming. I said overwhelming. It was so overwhelming. So even though as a standardized patient, I train to teach people in the medical industry how to communicate and interact with human beings, I didn't feel very much like I was being treated like one. I felt like, you know, and I have to give all due respect to the people there in the room that they were thinking I'm having a stroke and they're trying to, you know. So then they come in and they start to tell me that they're going to put a tube in my groin, go up in, and I let them know that's not happening. And I didn't quite say it like that, but when they said that, I let them know. My right foot went up in the air, my arm, and I said, hell to the no. And my girlfriend says, you heard that, didn't you? She said, hell to the no. So they came in with, they gave me some sort of a beta blocker. They explained what it was, and I wanted to know the side effects, and they explained that the side effects were death. And so my girlfriend's looking at me, and I'm like, statistics. Now, I'm trying to get all this out while I'm paralyzed. So it's not coming out, but my girlfriend's saying she wants to know the statistics. And they explained to me every 6 people out of 100 die. The other results are very favorable, you know. They do that the job. They do the job very well. And so they did give me that, what, you know, I think, I don't even want to begin to tell you what it was, but I can tell you that it cost goo gobs of money.
Whatever it was. Oh, streptokinase.
So the end result, I was there for about 36 hours, went through all kinds of therapy and tests and blood work and being poked and prodded and taking all kinds of vital signs. And they came, the final result was they told me that because I don't have high blood pressure and I didn't have high cholesterol, that they deduced that my diagnosis was a TIA, which they explained as transient ischemic attack, and
yep.
Transient meaning come and go, ischemic meaning blockage of blood or oxygen, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, an attack of the lack of that. And
meaning that it's just sudden, it's a sudden thing.
Sudden thing, yeah. And then they said, you know, usually people who have that, we call them mini strokes, but usually people that have that, it happens a second time, you know, sometimes very soon, sometimes not. And I really wasn't satisfied with those results, you know. I mean, and then, you know, they wanted me to do follow-up, which I did. And my vital signs were even better than they were then, because even during my traumatic state, while my vital signs were high, they weren't at a level that you would consider, you know, high blood pressure or, you know, but, you know, whatever it was, you know, when you're under a trauma, they understand that that can send your blood pressure skyrocketing. But mine wasn't even that. So
did they offer you medications, long-term medication to help you?
Well, you know, when they discharged me, they came in and they wanted to discharge me. I was very excited to get out of there because I wanted to get home and get rest because I was not getting any kind of rest in there. And they asked me, they recommended, they wanted me to get on some medication for precautionary measures. And I refused to take it because the medication that they were giving me was for high blood pressure and high cholesterol. And I didn't want to take either one because I didn't have either one of them, and I didn't understand why I was, you know, being prescribed a medication when I didn't have any of that. And then when I said to them, you know, why would I take something, medication for something I don't have? And they said, well, it was for precautionary measures, you know, because this could potentially happen again. Well, I want to know what I could do to prevent it from happening again. You know, and there, it's like, well, it's one of those medical, in your case, it's one of those medical mysteries. We know that there was some sort of blockage. You don't have brain damage. It wasn't any bleeding. They put me through every scan, CT scans and MRIs and all kinds of tests that I passed with flying colors. And I'm not boasting or bragging or anything. I'm very grateful because the experience
is really
enlightening.
Let's have to point out here that
yeah.
You, the medical model, were not ever instructed to refuse therapy. And no one ever told you to curse at a doctor, I'm sure.
No,
but you,
no.
The real patient,
that's,
I mean,
right.
You
we're
just
not
were not a model
no.
patient. What happened?
Oh. Say that again?
I said you were not a model patient.
I wasn't a model patient, but, you know, I
yeah.
have to say that they handled me very well. They listened.
Okay.
They did
yeah.
follow my instructions. They did not insert a tube. And I probably,
yes.
I know I wouldn't have let them. They did. They when I asked them to tell me what they were going to do before they did it, they did. So you know, I don't know that the average patient would do that or would just let them do whatever they think they need to do. But I'm a believer, and you need to be very proactive in what's happening to you. You know more about you than anyone because you live inside you. And you know when you have pings and pangs, and you need to be able to communicate that and work together as a team, I think. So anyways, I did all the follow-up and everything, and they told me, well, it's one of those medical mysteries. It's a mystery. We may never know why it happened. And you
then
know,
what
I'm,
happened?
Well, after that, I haven't heard from them. I did follow up. I did go through more tests and accumulate more medical bills. And then they told one of the doctors that I did a follow-up with, she says, okay, well, you should walk. You can start walking now. You know, she asked me if I did any kind of exercise, and I told her that, you know, my teaching, I teach after-school program and I direct, so I'm on my feet. I'm very active. I don't do any regimented exercise. So I agreed to walk. And but I haven't started walking yet because I haven't felt very comfortable doing that, but I am.
Okay, so now you're sitting around with all this information, feeling like you should walk, but you really didn't feel comfortable walking, and then I called you, right?
That's right. Well, then you called me to invite me to be a guest on your show, and as we were talking about it, I said, guess what, Dr. Daniels, I had a TIA. At that time, it was almost like, it was probably like a week out, maybe 2 weeks out. And you said, what? Oh, my God, you're too young to have a TIA. You know, I'm older than you. And then, then you went on, and I didn't even explain the circumstances, what I did and, you know, all of that. But you came out, and you just probably said, well, you know, you've probably been eating a lot of salty foods and you know, exerting yourself and not drinking a lot of fluids, and you probably were dehydrated. And when you said that, that's when I shared, oh, my God, how did she know that? Because I was at a Super Bowl party, and, you know, from Thanksgiving up through, oh, my God, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, and the inauguration, and birthdays. Yeah, I've been eating a lot of, you know, foods that I don't ordinarily eat, and I've been also drinking socially. And haven't been taken in the water, and it has been frigid. And you had shared with me that cold weather, you know, it can dehydrate you, and all those salty foods, it can dehydrate you. And so all the things that can dehydrate you, I was doing it to the fourth power. And so here I was at the Super Bowl party, and it just pretty much came to a head. But, you know, no one explained to me that a possible option is that you could be dehydrated. They just went through all of this other stuff that came to over $50,000.
$50,000. Now, that $50,000 was the standard of care.
That $50,000, yep.
Was the standard of care. Had you actually known, if you'd been knowledgeable, you could have drank approximately 1 pint of water or two, and you would have just come to right then and there at the party. And even if you couldn't
They told me not to drink water. When they had 911 on the phone, I wanted to drink water. And
yeah,
they
because
said,
that
no,
might reverse
no,
your symptoms, and they wouldn't be able to justify the $50,000 in expenses. And this happens a lot in medicine. For example, ladies in labor will come to the emergency room, they're in labor, oh, nothing to eat or drink, and the lack of water just for that hour or two is enough to create fetal distress and a need for a C-section. So a lot of this happens, doctors are given these types of instructions for the standard of care. Even the doctor doesn't really realize what's going on because he's not the one making the rules. They're just handed down to him as these mysterious rules that were researched by eminent scientists, and this is what they decided is the best thing to do. And the doctor says, oh, okay, I'll do that. So that's one thing. The other thing that you point out, your case points out, it's an extremely good illustration, is that the risk factors, hypertension, high cholesterol, whatever you want the risk factors to be, are generally absent, by the way, in stroke. These things are classified as risk factors when they actually are not very prominent factors are not even present in most strokes.
Wow.
So why are they classified as risk factors? Because then you get a whole industry called risk factor modification. And so you are just a totally, what happened to you is absolutely, totally, completely typical. So you had a case of dehydration, which I told you, for God's sake, don't drink anything. Now, their excuse for not drinking was you might choke on it. Well, even if you choke, what are you going to choke on, a teaspoonful? And your friends will say, oh, she's choking, let's not give her any more water. Or at the point where you were complaining about call 911, if you had drank at that point, by the time 911 showed up, you would have been just fine.
Wow.
But people are not told these things. In fact, if you get into the stroke prevention thing, I'll say, as soon as someone starts slurring their speech, you think it might be a stroke, don't give them anything to drink. Well, that just guarantees that the poor 911 crew is going to find just a paralyzed, half-paralyzed blob on the floor, so to speak, and make sure everybody has work. So
you know what's
really,
so interesting? My body was telling me to drink water because I started drinking water. I had drank, you know, one cup of water, and then when they had got to 911, they stopped giving me water. But I was saying that I wanted water. And then
they need to give you the water in the plastic bags through your vein for several hundred dollars instead of the glass of water, which might be free. That was the issue.
Absolutely. And there were a lot of signs before all of that I just didn't know. Like I had prior to even the Super Bowl party, but months or so, like the week before this happened, I was having headaches, and I thought it was the red wine I was drinking. I thought it was the tannins in the red wine. And this is definitely an indication that we need to pay more attention to our bodies, and when our bodies are trying to tell us something, we need to pay attention to it. Because had I really paid attention to all of the signs, because, for example, with the dehydration, I have this funny feeling in my mouth where if I ran my tongue above my teeth, up above my teeth and below my teeth, it was always tacky and sticky, you know, it kind of was metallic tasting or something. And I pointed it out to people, and I said, wow, this is really weird. I don't know what this is.
You're dehydrated. Drink some water.
Yeah. And the thing of it is, I drink water. I drink a lot of water. But when I found out how much more I should have been drinking based on all of what I was doing, wow. So now
yeah,
I drink water where I get up at least once a night and I tinkle. And actually, that stuff in my mouth went away.
Yep. There you go.
Like,
we have to identify our station. I'm going to get in trouble. So let me say something here. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit VitalityCapsules.com and get your free gift, Herbal Remedies So Powerful They Could Make Antibiotics Obsolete. And that's VitalityCapsules.com. As always, this is Dr. Daniels. I welcome your calls and questions, so please give us a call at 914-338-0695. That's 914-338-0695. All right, I did it. Are you there?
That's it?
Oh, no, I should give through station notifications so you can go on talking.
Oh, okay. So, you know, I have a question. Can I ask a question even though I'm a guest?
Yes, you can ask a question even though you're a guest.
So what should I have been told? And leaving the hospital, what should I know? If someone is listening to this, what should they know leaving the hospital after having a TIA?
Okay, so you've actually asked a very, very ambiguous question. So one question is, what should they have been told? And the answer is, you were told exactly what you should have been told. The standard of care was followed meticulously, and you should have been told to take cholesterol medications, because obviously your cholesterol, even though it's in the normal range, was not low enough to prevent a stroke, so that was correct. You should have been put on some kind of anticoagulant, aspirin a day, anything. You should have been offered actually really a panoply of preventative medications. So everything was done precisely and absolutely correctly.
Okay.
Nothing was, you know, so far the standard of care was, it was meticulously adhered to. The people who took care of you were competent, well-trained, and I'm sure board-certified doctors. So that's that answer, but that's probably not really the question you were asking. The question you were asking might have been, what information would have benefited you
okay.
at that point? Does that sound like a reasonable interpretation of your question?
That sounds like a great interpretation.
Okay. You should have at that point been told. In fact, even when you entered the hospital, you should have been told there are no tests necessary. We're going to put in D5 half normal saline or normal saline wide open, and a guy could just look at his watch and 10 minutes, boom, you'd have been just fine. And so you know what? Next time you go to a party, if you're going to eat that stuff, drink a glass of water after each handful of chips. And then we won't even ever see you again. So if someone had just told you to alternate a glass of water with your potato chips or your corn chips or Doritos or maybe they had these salty sausage sandwiches or sausage little tidbits or hors d'oeuvres that they often serve at soccer ball parties, that alone would have just solved your problem completely. So, and I tell this to my even to my patients who drink alcohol, and maybe their alcohol is giving them a problem and they don't feel like they want to stop, I say, look, drink a glass of water after each, before and after each drink, and do that. And they've reported back to me that that actually solves all of their problems. They feel just great. So it's the same thing when you're eating those dry, crunchy, snacky things. So that's one thing. In the first place, just even going to the hospital, once you got to the hospital, they could have just handled it right then and there. In fact, when I was a medical doctor, I treated strokes as an outpatient. I didn't even send them to the hospital because the therapy they got at the hospital was just so bizarre. It was just outrageous. And what got me started doing that was I actually had a patient stop by the office on my day off. I was there doing paperwork. He says, I don't like my doctor. I've had two strokes, and he keeps putting me on these blood pressure drugs, and I keep having strokes, and I'm going to switch to you. I was like, okay. But look, here, sign this thing. Give it to your doctor. He'll send me your records, and I'll give you an appointment for 3 weeks. All right, no problem. So he shows up 2 weeks on a Saturday with half of his body paralyzed. And I said, excuse me, Mr. Jones, this is not an emergency room. You have to go to the emergency room because you are having a stroke. You've had a stroke. And he had the same slurred talk you did. And he said, no, I'm here. You do the best you can. I'm not going back to that hospital because I had strokes before and they didn't help me and they didn't help me prevent one. So here I am. You do the best you can. And actually, he did very well. He totally reversed his stroke using natural, just dietary and herbs, and was able to go back full-time to his job driving a bus.
Wow.
So, the first thing, I mean, the word in the street is, as soon as you're having a stroke, call 911 and go to the hospital. Another alternative vision is to immediately start drinking. You can call 911, but immediately start drinking. And if you're able to drink, keep drinking. And by the time 911 gets there, you know, they can do whatever they want. You guys can work it out, whatever you want to do. So one thing is to stay hydrated. So that's one thing that they should have told you, that water is a universal solvent. You stay hydrated. You won't have any more of these things. But you skip out in your water, and you will be back to see us. And next time it might not be so pretty. So that would be the one thing that you should have been told. And then, I mean, you could have been told other things like that sticky, tacky, thick stuff in your mouth is a sign of dehydration. You should drink. But the real thing that helps you to know is whenever you feel hungry, interpret that as thirst and drink a glass of water first. Then if you're still hungry, eat. But you should never, eating should never be your first response to hunger. Because in our culture, because of the way we're conditioned, a lot of sitting, a lot of indoor stuff, whatever, we are not conditioned to drink. So as soon as you feel hunger, the first thing you do is drink a glass of water. Then if you're still hungry, you know, go ahead and eat. So I have to say, what's a glass of water? A glass of water for an adult is 12 to 16 ounces.
Okay. And how many of those did you have in a day?
Well, again, we're talking to somebody who's shown up with a stroke, a TIA. You know the person's severely dehydrated. You know that they're not really doing anything they should be doing. So I just told you how to prevent a stroke. But to be even healthier, you should definitely drink 1 quart of water for every 60 or 50 pounds of body weight, and you really should stick to that. You're going to pee a lot, but it's better to pee a lot than to be paralyzed or have a heart attack. So that's the way that one works.
So
we have
quarter,
a question here.
One quart of water for every 50 pounds of body weight?
Yep.
Okay.
Now, another piece of information here is salt. You need to drink salt or eat salt. And so one of those quarts, it would be nice if it had a teaspoon of salt in it.
Okay, but if you're getting salt from, because there's salt in everything, and that's another thing, even when I'm eating now, everything tastes so salty to me now. Everything is like, oh, my God, you know, I've been really...
Well, it depends on who's cooking it, and so if you're buying packaged food that has salt in it, but a lot of people no longer buy packaged food, so if you're in an area where you no longer are buying packaged food, you're just buying produce and... you know, vegetables, you know, like beans and rice,
yeah,
so to speak.
I don't do processed. You know, I try to stay away from processed because, and even now when I do eat something that, you know, I used to really, really, really love hot dogs, but they've become so salty to me, I can't tolerate them.
Exactly. Also, if you have too much salt like that, you have to add a lot of water. Okay, let's see what this what our guest or one of our listeners here has to say. Got the little hand up. Okay, I'm gonna hit this button again. Okay, 2042, you're on the air. Hello, did you have a question? Okay, we're going to mute this person. If you do *1, it raises your hand. All right. So let me go down. Okay, no more questions. All right. Yeah, so most people are following a regimen where they don't eat salt. They don't put salt in their food, but they eat processed food that has a lot of salt already added by the factory or the manufacturer, whoever's processing or preparing the food. Another trap is eating at restaurants, and that's just fraught with difficulties because restaurants, you know, they flavor their food, but a lot of their flavorings are chemicals, and those flavorings can cause issues and difficulties.
Wow. So in walking, if cold weather can cause dehydration, you know, I live in central New York, you know, and if
right.
I'm going to walk, I would prefer to walk outside, but it's going to be cold.
Right. It is.
What is your recommendation on that?
All right. I'm very familiar with Syracuse, so I can tell you exactly what to do. You need to bundle up, put on your mittens, and you need to get those boots that have the really rough tread so you can't slip on the ice and snow up there, or you could kill yourself. So you're going to get some really deep tread boots, or like maybe a half inch or 1 inch deep on the tread, so that way you don't fall or slip. Okay, so now you're all ready, you're bundled up, you're ready to go. Drink a quart of water before you leave the house.
Okay.
And what's going to happen is you're actually going to have to pee in about 5 or 10 minutes probably. But you want to walk, the therapeutic amount of walking is half an hour. So you want to leave your house, walk for 15 minutes, take your time, no rush, no need to rush, and turn around and walk back. The purpose of this walk is to stimulate your circulation, to get your blood circulating all the way out to your fingers and your toes, and it literally causes your blood to not thicken and to not get stiff, and it's an incredible therapy. Now, what do you do about the fact that you're going to have to pee and you're going to be out there in the cold? It would be nice if you had a friend at the 10-minute point, you could just duck in and use their potty and then continue your walk.
Yeah, I can manage that and map that out for sure.
Okay. All right, so you need a quart of water, 1 quart of water. That'll do you for 15 minutes out, 15 minutes back. The reason you need the quart of water is because when you're just sitting, you have something called an effective volume of circulation. Your blood is really only circulating to your vital organs and your central core. That blood is not circulating all the way out to your fingertips and all the way out to your toes. So, of course, your body can get by with a smaller volume of blood. And so if you're going to walk, what happens is that blood gets drained from your core, from your head, out to your fingers and toes. And you can actually pass out and hit the pavement if you don't drink that water before you get started. And so for a doctor to tell you, who just had a stroke, to, go walk, and not tell you to tank up with water beforehand, she's setting you up to have that second TIA that she predicted for you.
Wow.
Yeah. And so then you're going to have the second TIA, and you're going to fall out, and you're going to say, that doctor was right. I should have taken those drugs.
it's all planned out, huh?
They kind of got it planned out. So I have to say, when I attended medical school, I was really shocked. I was appalled at how ineffective and harmful most therapies were. And I asked questions like, how can we recommend something like this when it doesn't work? And I was told that there was ongoing research that would find the answers. And until then, we're obligated to use the available methods. And this latest generation of doctors, these young people, are not bothered by these very troubling, just distressing observations I was having, because their exposure to real patients is limited, and they see really the paid medical model, which is you. When I was in medical school, patients were cursing all the time. They were refusing therapy. They weren't cooperating. I mean, I'm like, wait a minute. We can't do this. We have got to do something else because this isn't really addressing what patients wanted. I didn't become a doctor to be a target. So the medical model or being used as a form of teaching makes it easy for doctors to follow deadly therapies, like the deadly therapy your doctor recommended on discharge from the hospital, which is basically, oh, you've had a stroke, no problem. Just start walking more, and no mention of water, whatever. You know, this worked in medical school, is what the patient is what doctors are thinking. Well, it's worked in medical school, and, you know, everything worked out fine. And they mutter this to themselves as the patients die right before their eyes. And the problem is the expectation becomes that patients will actually behave like model patients, you know, and never refuse things and, you know, mention things politely. And then if they don't, the patient, not the therapy, is at fault. And the protocols are followed and the patients die. And they die to the tune of 787,000 a year. That's how many people every year.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, they die as a result of receiving medical care. And the employment of medical models, because you don't know this, but historically, like when I went to medical school, dark ages, they would not allow a medical student to even see a patient until a third year of medical school. Because if you allow a student to see a patient and see that patient complaining about ineffective therapy and see that patient protesting and see that patient refusing and see that patient being angry, they might take it the wrong way and they might lose faith in the standard of care. So if you indoctrinate the student first and get 2 years of indoctrination and very high student loans under his belt, then when he sees these patients carrying on like this, he's going to rationalize it. So using this medical model allows them to even further delay the point at which the medical student sees a very distressing thing. Another thing I'd like to mention is there's another medical model. This medical model is a theoretical model. This is a medical model followed for every drug that's marketed. Find something in nature that works, make an artificial imitation, patent it, determine the lethal dose. Now, remember from prior radio shows I've mentioned it to our audience, the medical definition of a lethal dose is the dose at which 50% of those who take it will die from it. Anything less than that, 50% death rate, is not a lethal dose. And then they create a therapeutic dose that's equal to a fraction of the lethal dose. And that you experienced that when they told you, oh, yeah, I'll give you this beta blocker and 6% chance it'll kill you. And the doctor prescribes this dose until the patient dies with the medication. It's called take it for the rest of your life. And it really means take it until it kills you. And this ensures that 107,000 people die from properly prescribed medication. So, hey, our board here is lighting up, so we're going to take some calls. 7376, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, did you have a question? Hello?
Hello, Dr. Daniel?
Yes, did you have a question? Uh-huh.
Yes, I do. Thank you for this very informative program. A couple of things. My elderly mom is 86, and over the past year she has had several bouts of gastritis.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very concerned because, for one thing, she doesn't seem to want to eat anything anymore because she's afraid of eating.
Yeah, it hurts.
Yes. And so the other thing that I'm worried about is that her bowel habits have changed quite drastically. She never really had any problems before the onset of the gastritis over the past year. But now she has a very difficult time eliminating. And although I am trying to get her to drink, I now have to give her constantly something that helps her to move.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to get your thoughts and feedback. And I'll tell you, it's a little worrying to me because my grandmother, my mother's mother, died of colon cancer. And now that she's suddenly beginning to have all this trouble passing, I'm beginning to be concerned, oh, my gosh, I hope this is not that, you know, or something serious.
All right. So the question is she taking an aspirin a day or what's she taking?
She is taking an aspirin a day.
Okay. That
she
is
also takes blood pressure, high blood pressure medication.
Yeah. The aspirin a day has caused her gastritis.
Oh.
And until you stop that, it will never go away, the gastritis. So
okay.
The aspirin a day is the cause of her gastritis. The high blood pressure medication is most likely the cause of her constipation. Is she on a calcium channel blocker?
I'm not terribly knowledgeable. I could tell you.
So
if
check
I
it out. Ask, you know, if she has a calcium channel blocker, you can look them up on the internet. Calcium channel blockers notoriously cause constipation, and this is really kind of what the show is bringing out: is that most of the afflictions people experience are due to the medications that they're taking. Now, once you stop her aspirin a day, that's going to be helpful to her, and then you can you should notice her tolerance for food increases a lot. And then I have to do this disclaimer: this is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease, and any advice you accept is at your own risk, and I'm not liable and all that stuff. So disclaimer.
Right.
And you can give her fennel tea. Fennel tea will settle her stomach and clear it up very easily.
Okay.
And you can check out my website, vitalitycapsules.com, and the Vitality Capsules will get her pooping.
Now, I am taking the Vitality Capsules myself at this time, and just very quickly, I have polymyalgia. And I want to take the remedy that you use, the turpentine remedy.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to get myself prepared to take that. And I've been on prednisone for the polymyalgia for over 7 years, but I know I have a candida problem. So I'm just wondering, with that background, should I be take any other precautions before I actually take getting to the point where I take the turpentine? I'm trying to
wean off.
Yeah,
I would say you need to go through steps 1 through 4 of your protocol there. Really go back over them a lot more. Before you consider turpentine, you should have the feeling that your prednisone dose could be lowered. You should have a feeling, you know, that things are pretty stable and pretty steady. You know what I mean? So what I'm saying is you have to go back over and your diet really meticulously, make sure it matches the diet there in the document that you got there. And you can actually go to my website and click Contact Us, and I do have a program for guidance and individualized counseling if you want to go for that. All right. Okay, Annette.
Yes.
I think that's, we have, we've finished, oh my God, we're done. We're off the air. I don't know if we're off the air, but I think that's the end of the show. We've answered all the questions and everything. Thank you very, very much. It's really a pleasure to have you. I think you really added a lot and helped our audience understand a lot of things that were going on.
Well, thank you for having me, and I will be in touch. I did get your email about the type of B vitamin, and I will be in touch with you because I've got some other questions, but, you know, right now I've got to run into rehearsals.
All right. Bye-bye.
And
thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Danz. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. I'll be in touch.